are listening to a podcast of The View, where we discuss today's topics from an anti-racist, anti-oppressive, multicultural perspective. This podcast is brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To subscribe, visit questformeaning.org or search for Church of the Larger Fellowship in the iTunes Store.
Hello, welcome to National Coming Out Day. And hey, we'll make it International Coming Out Day on The View. I'm Meg Riley, and it's my 40th year of living as a big old queer. I have always called myself a lesbian, truthfully and with more complexity. I'm bisexual, but I have had 40 years of relationships with women for which I am eternally grateful. Today, I come to you from Whitefish, Montana, where I've been for the week, looking at Glacier Park, meeting with the good UUs here, and otherwise living a life. Michael Tino, how and where are you?
Good morning, everyone. Greetings from Peekskill, New York, where I didn't do the math this morning, and I probably should tell you how long it's been since I first came out, but queer here in Peekskill, too, and it's nice to be with you on National Coming Out Day. Jess, holding down the tech fort in Seattle. How are things there?
Holding down the tech fort here in Seattle. I'm super excited for this show as well. I have a 10-year-old son who came out when he was 5 and wanted me to mention that today because he's out. So I'm really happy to celebrate today. And I'm going to be on Twitter, hashtag The View. I'm on Facebook Live, fielding your questions and comments for our guests and hosts. So make sure you post some stuff there and celebrate with us.
So I think we've seen the power of coming out recently with the Me Too movement and all of the women and people of other genders coming out related to sexual abuse and sexual misconduct. And today we're going to share some powerful stories which include pain, but which are also stories of joy and power. And just to say that even if it appears that we're not being listened to, which it certainly has appeared on many fronts with many stories, still the power of telling the stories allows you to find the people that you want to know. So we're really happy to have a couple of special guests today, and both of them have to leave early. So we're gonna jump in with their stories, and I'm really excited to hear them. Linda Susan Ulrich. Reverend Linda Susan Ulrich is the assistant minister at the First UU Congregation of Ann Arbor. She identifies as bisexual and queer and uses she, her pronouns. Reverend Dawn Fortune serves the UU Congregation of the South Jersey Shore in Galloway, New Jersey. Where is that, Dawn? Where's Galloway, New Jersey?
We are about 15 minutes from Atlantic City and about an hour from Philadelphia.
Oh, okay, right around there.
We are technically below the Mason-Dixon line.
Okay, interesting. So, New Jersey, didn't know. So Dawn is in the second year of ministry there. Dawn identifies as queer and genderqueer and uses they, them pronouns. And I see that Nori Rost has found us, hastily joining us thinking that we were in a different time zone. Welcome, Nori. And Nori, I know, is in Colorado Springs, Colorado, the hotbed of the religious right, or well, where the belt buckle just keeps getting bigger. But anyway, Nori, if you'll introduce yourself when you speak. But let's start with Linda Susan. Linda Susan, tell us a story.
Oh boy. Let's see. Well, one of my coming out stories is that I have to keep coming out over and over and over because there's not a lot of bi visibility in the world. And so I keep trying to change that one story at a time, and especially being in married to a woman. And so everyone will be like, oh yes, you're a lesbian. I'm like, I love my lesbian sisters, but neither of us is lesbian. Actually, we're both identified as bi. But I keep doing that because I know how important it is. I know a lot of people who haven't been able to come out or don't feel safe coming out as bi or don't don't want to risk coming out as bi because they're afraid people will reject them or not want to date them or whatever it might be. So I just keep doing that as often as I can. And sometimes it's a little awkward because I just got to like slip it right in. And also it can be awkward. You know, my partner had an experience not too long ago where she was wanted to just let the person know that she was meeting up with, that she's bi, but she realized that the way it sounded, it might sound like she was propositioning the person when that was not at all it. And she's like, this sucks. Why can't I just say who I am? And it's not a thing. But it is a thing. So she figured out a different way to say it. I was fortunate when I first came out, I believe now 28 and a half years ago. I think I've done the math right, because it was during college and I lived in a kind of co-op house where there were a lot of other people already out as bi. So I knew my friends weren't going to reject me. I knew that, you know, there was already a place for me. It didn't make it a ton easier because there's still the whole, you know, the rest of the universe gets all weird about it. But at least I knew that my closest cohort was going to be supportive. There's some story.
Yeah, that's great. And we'll have some more stories. Don Fortune, how about you? Can you tell us a story?
I can tell stories.
Tell us stories.
Poor Amos. Let's see. Coming out, I have become sort of one of those like elder folks, you know, now who are like, back when I was a kid, we rode our dinosaurs to pride. And I came out when Ronald Reagan was still president, which is right, Linda's. Yeah, that back in the dark ages. I grew up, and it's interesting, I grew up in a very conservative area. As a young person, I had a lot of self-internalized homophobia and gender phobia. And so I identified earlier, I was very homophobic because I couldn't deal with the reality that was in front of me. And so when I came out, I identified as bi for about a month. And then I identified as lesbian for a long time. And then as years went on, you know, it's interesting, after I hit 40, weird things happened. And I began to, open my understanding of gender and what that meant. I was doing a lot of spiritual work. I was doing a lot of healing work. And I was able to embrace the understanding that I am genderqueer, at least for this moment. So I identify as sort of transmasculine. And with that, I was also able to sort of loosen up on my understanding of my sexual and romantic orientation. And so now I identify as queer because it's a much broader term and more inclusive. And it, for me, it means that I identify as someone who's attracted to people of a variety of genders. So that's where I am now. And, you know, being the only trans-identified minister for probably 50 miles is a little strange, but I've got a real strong church community here who's done the work and is supportive.
So can I ask you a question?
Sure.
It sounds like opening up the binary around gender also opened up the binary or something around sexuality for you.
Yes.
Is that how you would describe that?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, and I'm going to delve a little bit into the medical stuff. I started 2 or 3 years ago, very low doses of testosterone. And so now I have the Bobby Brady voice. It's kind of alarming because I can squeak when I need to. But it was at that time when I really began to to find myself attracted to people who were genders other than women. So it was part the emotional evolutionary stuff I was doing for my own gender, that, and chemicals, because hormones are chemicals. There's a reason they're you know, protected classes of chemicals, because they do stuff. So the combination of the internal work and the chemical work really made room for that to open up for me. Does that answer?
Yes, I hope. It does. No, thank you. Okay. And I don't mean to pry. I'm just curious.
I think
that one of the gifts of the gender, queer, and trans community is really opening all of us up to think about a lot of binaries that are not really helpful, you know, whether they're spiritual binaries or whatever kinds of binaries. It's just, I find it language that's very liberating. And for some people, it's language in that lives in their bodies, you know, more than others.
Well, just to sort of piggyback on that, I don't want to take too much time. When I first came out, it was the 1980s. And there, what I had for role models for how to be queer was a very limited model. My understanding of myself as butch and my comfort in presenting as in a masculine way was very much judged and shamed by the lesbian community at the time, because that was considered to be buying into the patriarchy. Right? You want to be the oppressor. I'm like, no, I just want to be me. And this is how I'm comfortable. But at that time, the standard issue lesbian uniform was the like non-threatening social worker, Birkenstock wearing. I mean, you know, it was this sort of very non-threatening, very gender neutral presentation for bodies that were identified as female. And it just didn't fit for me. So thankfully, I'm not on the leading edge of any sort of gender revolution here by any means. But when that happened, I began to have language for what I was feeling. And I think that's the biggest part of what coming out does, is it gives those of us who don't have language words to explain what's been going on inside and a way to express that.
If I can jump in for one sec.
Sure, jump in.
About the thing about the language is that that's part of why I keep the label bisexual, is that for me, it never had anything to do with the binary. It's just, I'm attracted to people of my gender and people of other genders, which pretty much covers all the territory I can think of. But it's a really important term historically and politically for people to be able to find community. Because when you look up, you know, and thankfully things are opening up where people can find much more specifically language that describes their experience accurately. And I still think that, I mean, a lot of us use bi plus as the umbrella term for like pansexual and sexually fluid and a whole host of others. That ability to find your people is a big part of why I don't let that go. So I just wanted to toss that in.
Thanks. Nori Ross, you identify as queer and use she, her, hers, but tell us more about yourself. Tell us some stories about your coming out.
I think I may be the eldest elder because I am actually celebrating this month my 40th anniversary of coming out.
Me too, Nori.
I came out in 1978 when I was 16 years old, and I remember my actual coming out story is different from many people because I wasn't raised in a religious home, and I didn't have any like Christian or other type of trappings around what queerness might be or homosexuality might be, and I had no clue. So one day I was working at the Bonanza Steakhouse, And the owner had said her daughter and roommate from Chicago were going to come and manage it. So I'm in the back room bussing tables. I'm in that brown polyester skirt and that orange cowboy print polyester shirt and this misfitting cowboy hat on my head. And in walk these two lesbians who I can only describe as a 1978 lesbian chic. They had short feathered hair. They had on Dockers. They had on polo shirts. And I looked at them and in my head, I said two things. I said, that's it. They're lesbian and so am I. It was just like that. It was like the Ugly Duckling seeing the swans flying overhead. And I flew out of the closet because I finally felt I had a place where I belonged. I lived my whole life, and this was in Topeka, Kansas, by the way. So, you know, not the bastion of liberalism or anything. But I lived my whole life thinking, I don't fit in. Where do I fit in? And then it was like I had found my tribe, and I flew out of the closet because I was very claustrophobic. I wore a t-shirt to a high school that said, how dare you presume I'm heterosexual. I wore a tuxedo to my senior prom. I went with a gay boy who was a junior. He wanted to wear a dress. And I'm like, Eric, you still have one more year with these people. I'm just going to say let's wear matching tuxedos. So my whole life just projects from that point of being in that back room at the Bonanza Steakhouse and seeing Jamie and Pat walk in. And I have, I've never looked back. And I mean, as a result of that, I was kicked out of my house the following year when I was a senior, but, you know, that's my trajectory. And I embodied that differently. At that time, I identified as lesbian. And in Topeka, Kansas, Don, Butch and Femme were the deal of the day. It was fabulous. Although I just kind of looked grungy, basically. So what I've embodied that differently in terms of who I identify as a lesbian. I've been really quote unquote butch, and then I went to this really femme period, and now I think of myself as a tomboy femme. It's like jeans or a little black dress and not a lot in between. But I identify as queer because I also recognize, well, probably I would identify best as sapiosexual, which means I'm really attracted to intelligent people because it's all about the energy for me. I don't have a type. I don't have a butch femme type.
Can you say that word again for people who aren't familiar with it, Nori?
Sapiosexual, which means you're attracted to intelligence. And that, for me, has always been about the energy. And I've certainly had great energetic connections with all genders, cis and trans, trans men, trans women, cis men, cis women. So although I've landed in relationships my life, my 40 years of being out with women, I recognize that energy is there. And there was a time when I was a minister with Metropolitan Community Church and, you know, here in Colorado Springs especially, I thought, dear God, don't let me fall in love with a man. That would be worse to come out with than being queer at that point because I was a professional lesbian. But I thought it happened to Joanne Loon and it could happen to me too. But it hadn't. So.
For people who weren't around in 1979, can you say who Joanne Llewellyn is?
Joanne Llewellyn is, I think she still considers herself a lesbian, a fabulous lesbian sex expert. I actually went to see her give a lecture on lesbian sex with my partner for one of our anniversaries way back in the day. And then when she was about 50, she came out as having fallen in love with a man. And it was this huge shockwave went through the lesbian community at the time. And Many who felt like she betrayed them and others who, you know, felt like you can't say you're a lesbian if you're with a man. And again, how those labels can contain us rather than open us up. It's interesting.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of rigidity.
Yeah.
Quite a bit of rigidity. Yeah. Michael Tino, got some stories?
Oh, I have stories, but you know, it's really interesting. I was kind of hoping, Nori, that you would come out like 5 years ago because it's really weird for me to be like the baby queer. On the panel, having only come out 27 years ago, I did the math, in the George Herbert Walker Bush.
Let's just say if there are younger queers watching this who would like to come on, type a note on Facebook and we'll bring you over to tell a story. Because we are
absolutely
all a different generation than what it's like now. So do mention, we'll invite you on.
Well, and I want to get in some of the comments that people are putting on Facebook Live. Catherine Clarenbach says that she loves the way Dawn is describing the flexibility and evolution of coming out. Samantha Hall said, oh, Linda Susan, you had said that your wife was struggling to tell someone she was bi without it seeming like she was hitting on them, and she had to find a different way to say that. And Samantha is wondering what that way was. So we're going to put a pin in that. But, you know, the most fun part of my story, because I did get to come out in a liberal oasis of Ithaca, New York, though, you know, I had parents who I didn't know how they were going to react to my coming out. The most fun story I have is how and when I came out to my father, which was the day before the 1993 March on Washington. And at the time I was, I had graduated from college and I was living with my parents for a while before I went off to grad school. So I was living in their house and planning on driving down to Washington, D.C. And so I kind of figured that my father needed to know that where I was going to be and why, because it was probably going to be on the news. And so I sat down with my dad the day before the March on Washington, which, you know, Meg, I know you have stories about too. And it's funny. I was not a Unitarian Universalist at that point. So any consciousness of there being organized Unitarian Universalists at that march is totally lost on me. I found my people from Cornell and we marched together. But yes, I had to tell my dad, not only am I queer, and I guess I used the word gay at that point. Though it was interesting, when I came out, I came out as bisexual, not as an accurate description of to whom I was attracted, but as a marker that I didn't want lesbian and gay people circumscribing to whom I might be attracted. And I use that word, and I used to define myself in college as politically bisexual, because I was attracted to men and masculine people, but I wasn't gonna like let some social construct say you may not ever be attracted to feminine people or women. So yes, I had to sit down and come out to my dad before I made a 5-hour trip to Washington, D.C. to march with, what was it, a million people, and possibly be on the news. So Linda, Susan, do you want to let us know the answer to Samantha's question real quick?
Sure. It's not earth shaking. Basically, Emily was going to a conference and was for her work and had, you know, space in the room. And so she was offering it to folks who were maybe were paying for their own way. And so just wanting to offer this extra space to someone who couldn't afford a hotel room otherwise. And it was posted on some queer list. I don't remember what it was. And so there was someone who was interested and, you know, just in the little getting to know you thing, you know, it's on a queer list. So she was starting, you know, out with, you know, I'm bi and blah, 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 blah. And as I read it, or she had like that, is this, can you double check this for me? And I read it, I'm like, yeah, maybe just put that lower in the thing, like more about here's the hotel room and some of the details. I'll let you know more. By the way, you know, I'm married, you know, I'm married. I have a 6-year-old. I identify as bi. It just sort of like wrap it in the package of non-threateningness is really how it got resolved. And put just some of the details of, you know, this thing I'm offering to someone who needs it. So, but it sucks to have to think about that at all. That's the key thing, is that, you know, it, in a different context, you know, a different identity probably wouldn't have to do that kind of editing, self-editing. That's the part that makes it so painful and sad, is how much self-editing has to happen. And, you know, when does one choose to come out again and again? And, you know, Dawn had mentioned something about, you know, what are the costs of coming out? Because it's not free. freedom isn't free. And that sense of being invisible for me has been incredibly painful. And just, you know, the last time I was on The View, I talked about some of the really horrifying statistics, and they continue to be true about, you know, a lot of sexual assault and suicidality and so on and so forth. And these things that in other populations would be seen as like a public health emergency aren't even talked about. And that's just, that wears you down after a while. Yeah. So I just wanted to touch my tone.
That's really helpful. And it seems like the invisibility would be really different for if you're bisexual, but the world is perceiving you as heterosexual because the world keeps putting you in the lesbian box, right? But I mean, it just seems like what we want to do is control each other's sexuality by boxing everybody up and feeling like, oh, they're safe because they're there and I'm here. And, you know, because I know, and we joke about this, the whole way that The View got started as a show is that Joanna Fontaine Crawford, who's been married to her husband for decades, called me on the phone and said, I'm trying to figure out, I'm filling out this form to be on a UUA committee. They want to know my sexual orientation. I'm really bisexual, but I'm in this heterosexual. What are they asking me? You know, are they asking me, would I be a good conduit to communities? And so that just, I said, this is such a UU conversation that we're having. We should have a talk show to talk about things like this. And we joked about it and came up with the silly name, The View. And that's actually where this show started. But for Joanna, who that coming out was, she felt so good. And she came out, Linda Susan, I think the day that you were on Bisexual Visibility Day, because, and she's come out to her church. And so I think especially for bi people who are boxed up as heterosexual, which to my mind, I mean, not that lesbians can't be the most controlling people on the planet, she says, as someone who knows that community so well, but there are different boxes that people get thrown into and different pains for saying, no, actually not, you know, for different communities. But yeah, I think all of us who did come out early, you know, to my kid who's genderqueer, the fact that I'm, you know, an old dyke is just yawn. I never went through anything. And it's impossible to describe the fact that Dykes to Watch Out For was our only media, was the only reflection that we had of ourselves. That there weren't Will and Grace. I mean, as limited as popular culture may be, the only images we had either were pedophiles or suicidal. I mean, that really was all there was that we saw besides each other, which I think is why we were so desperate to control each other in really horrible ways. But I think that's why we were so desperate.
It's worth mentioning also that the suicidality, the images portrayed of gay people was part of the Hollywood code. That was by intention. If there was a gay character, they were required to either come out at the end of the movie, be dead or cured. So let's not forget that was intentional in our culture in that age.
Yeah, I'm just glad that there are more portrayals of bisexuals who don't wind up dead, denying themselves, or murdering someone, because usually they wind up murdering someone. So there was some, on Madam Secretary, there's not one, but two out bi characters who are awesome and not at all confused or anything. They're very clear who they are, and they're not killing anyone. Cannot tell you how I think I wept actually when each of them came out.
Yeah, and then for after those codes dawn, and thank you for lifting those up. The other option for women, of course, was that it was a phase to be with women and then marrying, and which is cured. But even you know, what was that one that came out recently? The Kids Are All Right. I was like, could there be a plot that didn't involve one of the women sleeping with a man? Like, could there just be that plot sometimes? But it feels like no, because nothing's happening if just two women. That's not really anything. So you just have to bring a man into it. Jess, do you want to tell your son's story? Because that is a young story.
yeah, I you know, it's funny. I mentioned that we were doing this show this morning and what the topic was, and he was like, "Tell them I'm gay." So he's at a, he's 10. And so he's at a interesting, you know, time and place where he is, sorry, I'm trying to talk and focus while I'm doing tech stuff. So he actually went to the Pride Parade in Seattle this year. And I want to see if I can show that photograph, because he's wearing a hat that says, "I'm gay and I like unicorns." And you can see that the outfit that he has on is some of his clothes and some of mine. So yeah, he's great. And you know, I mean, really, he came out at five. Like, he mentioned it to me at five, like one day when we were like playing trucks or something, like, you know, not like totally just total nothing moment. And then mentioned it again at seven, and then mentioned it to a few other people at seven. And then at 10 was like, "This is who I am, and I want everybody to know it." And so that's when he started wanting to wear shirts and hats and, you know, unicorn socks up to his knee. And I have to say, we live on an island, you know, off of Seattle. And I mean, it's literally an island of liberal people. Like, that's, it's a bubble. And, So he's super lucky, super, super lucky that at 10, he can put on pink shirts and go to school and tell everybody that he's gay, and he is met with love and affection. And he actually came out to a teacher and said to the teacher, "You know, I'm gay." And the teacher said to him, "Me too." And then they just sort of like went on with the rest of their day. And that's one of my favorite stories of him, because it was just like, that's it, you know? And I don't think this is unusual for his generation. And I'm fascinated by how this, what this will mean for when his generation are adults, and what that will mean.
As the parent of a 22-year-old genderqueer kid, I'll say that I think for 10-year-olds, it's probably better. It was incredibly painful to raise this kid, because it was fine until about age 8, when the genders, the boys hang here, the girls hang here, and there's no in between. And no one knew what to do with Jai. Like, the boys didn't want to hang out with Jai, and the girls didn't want to hang. And it was incredibly... Those pre, you know, by high school it was hip, but those years, those formative social years, were just incredibly painful. And Jai's very introverted and very smart and thinking, and just, and maybe a kid with a different personality. Liam sounds incredibly outgoing and stuff, but it was, there was a very heavy cost socially, and it was also very frightening. It was very frightening for me as a parent. And seeing my kid going to men's rooms at age 8 was very, very frightening to me. But women were so horrible to an 8-year-old who read as male. When people talk about this bathroom stuff, it's so visceral for me, because what did they think this 8-year-old would do to them? They were just these Minnesota white women just screaming at an 8-year-old who would not go to women's rooms after that. And, you know, as a parent with no father in the family to accompany, I lived in a great deal of fear about that. And I can't even begin to know, because I know that kids protect us. I know that my kid protected me from some of the worst of it, but just watching the social scene. But I do see more and more young kids transitioning and claiming different genders and being genderqueer, and, you know, 5-year-olds using they, them pronouns. And I mean, I feel like it's really opened up And I love that. And I'm really happy for those younger kids that hopefully the social scene will evolve to not be threatened if that becomes present in preschool instead of, I mean, I remember in preschool, the teacher said to me, you know, not everyone knows that your kid is a girl. Maybe you should tell your kid to wear dresses. So I said to Jai, you know, Jai, I wear skirts sometimes. And Jai said, that's great. You respond to them. I don't. And I went, oh, okay. We had that conversation then, you know, but so this was a kid. And at age five, I said, do you, and this I think is the quintessential gender queer thing. I said that question, that's always the trans question. Do you feel like you're in the wrong body? And Jai's at five says, no, this is my body. I feel like I'm in the wrong world. And I was Amen. Just like, okay, then we're good. So I, yeah.
I have to leave relatively soon, but I wanted to add one story about how things are different. Cause my 6.5-year-old plays around with gender, is currently like, he's kind of shifted around at various times saying, oh, I'm a boy, I'm a girl, I'm neither a boy nor a girl, which is where he is right now, though he still wants the he pronouns. Cause we check in every now and then. And also I've got this fantastic photo of him in this dress. He loves pink. And when he was in preschool, his first year of preschool, we had gone to like a, you know, like a rummage sale kind of thing. And he'd found these pink Mickey Mouse sneakers that he fell in love with, totally loved them. And he'd never shown much preference for clothes at all. He just didn't care much. So the fact that he actively loved these was kind of a big deal. And so, you know, on Monday morning, we're driving him to preschool and he wanted me to sit in the back seat with him. So I was doing that and just thinking, what can I say to preemptively protect my little guy who loves his shoes, his pink Minnie Mouse polka dot shoes, in case the kids are not kind to him? And but there was nothing to say. Like I racked my brain. And I was like, because I didn't want to say something in case nothing did happen, because then he's going to feel weird. And so I just like reiterated how much I love him and how much I love that he loves his shoes and crossed my fingers. So we walk into the preschool and he had the most fantastic teacher. And so, you know, we're coming in, there's this big open space across from, you know, you have to go through the little indoor play space to get to his classroom. And his teacher just happened to be coming on the other side of the blank space. And she said, look at those awesome shoes, or something like that. You got new shoes. They are fantastic. And I was like, oh my God. And so she then like, you know, we went over and she was loving up his shoes and she brought him into the classroom and said, look, everyone, look at Robert's shoes. Aren't they amazing? And, you know, everyone was just loving up his shoes. Apparently we found out later that she wound up changing the whole lesson for the day based on this book called My Pink Shoes or something like that. And they started to talk about this whole thing. And I still get choked up because I was so worried what could happen to my little guy and his love of just who he is. And then instead to have this teacher actively celebrate it and bring the other kids into it and normalize it was just incredible. So, you know, it's not going to be perfect. He's also gotten teased at school at various times for liking pink. But wow, how much better. And, you know, the fact that all of us have been out for so long is part of how that evolution happened. So I don't mind being an old timer, even with the costs, because my little guy is gonna have it, you know, wherever he lands on whatever spectrum, he's gonna have it so much easier. It's not gonna be easy necessarily. He may wind up being like, oh, you know, the pink thing, I'm kind of over it. Yeah, I really do feel like a boy. And I'm straight. sorry, moms. And that's okay, because he knows that it gets to be his decision. And I've been on a soapbox because, you know, it's my little guy and I love him a lot. So thanks for letting me talk about it.
Well, it's good to hear how it's changed. And I do want to name that it was harder for us than it was for people later. It was easier for us because of people that went before. And just to take a minute to really lift up and name some of the people in our own movement in Unitarian Universalism who were fired, who were jailed, who really paid a heavy price. And we did a show a long time ago with Rob Eller Isaacs, who was in LRY when Jim Stoll came out. He was the first UU minister to come out, never served a congregation, came out in 1969, and never was able to serve a congregation. And Rob said at the time that, I'm trying to remember which of the Seberg brothers was jailed for being sexual with another man, and actually served time in jail in the 50s, a beloved, you know, older minister when I met him, that, you know, it was really terrifying. My old boss, Gene Navius, who came out in the 50s, you know, he's dead now, but just had horrible stories to tell about the terror of being found out, and that, you know, a lot of General Assembly, the gay community, would disappear into bars. And I became the director of the GLBT office, which was just the GL office at the time, in 1992. And even then, the ministers, which is called UU Lambda Ministers, they met without any announcement in like this hotel room that you had to wander around and kind of know the secret handshake to get into. And in the they met after like everything else was over at like, you know, 11 at night. And it was weird, because at that point there were a bunch of out ministers, and I kind of looked around and said, who are we protecting by doing this? And we stopped. But for some of the people who did live their lives in closets, I just want to name the pain that they held, and also the people who dared to come out in those times. I think of Frank Robertson. I think of other people who lost jobs over it, and who I know even in the 90s, churches were afraid to hire queer ministers, which is pretty amazing now when you look around. But you know, I'll put a hat off to Chuck Gaines, who ran the extension department, who refused to send extension ministers to churches that wouldn't consider queer folks. And in fact, that's where a lot of folks got their first jobs, was in churches where it wasn't a search committee. It wasn't that process at all. They were just placed. And also to Mark Bellatini, who was out and in a church, and Doug Strong, Scott Alexander, some of those late 70s people, mid to late 70s, who were out. I was not out so I became a director of religious education and never planned to not be out. But the minister at the church where I was gave notice a month in, and I didn't know how to come out or who to come out to. And it turned out, so I had this big secret. It turned out the board had discussed at my very first board meeting, which I wasn't at because they didn't invite the DRE, they had discussed the fact that I was obviously queer, because it was pretty obvious, but no one ever told me that. So I thought it was a secret. And so it was horrible living in the closet. I mean, it was like, how was your weekend? Was, you know, I might've been celebrating my anniversary with all my best friends, and I would just say, oh, I went to a party. You know, you just neutralize and invisibilize your life to this degree that you are the most boring person on the planet. And when I went to China to adopt a kid, it was a whole bunch of lesbian couples, but it was like me and my business partner, me and my roommate, me and my, you know, sister-in-law, everybody had these cover stories. And we were the most boring bunch of women you would ever meet in your life, because we were all terrified that if we came out, of course, we wouldn't get our kids. And so nobody was saying anything about anything. And that, it sounds like, yeah, so you had to be in the closet. But closets just, they make you think everything about you might be fake. They make you wonder, especially if you're trying to serve a religious community, because after we finally got more opening, I ended up talking to lots of friends who were in Christian faiths that weren't, where they were would be fired if somebody outed them. And the cost of authenticity of who you are when you're trying to be a religious professional, it's kind of all you've got is who you are. And if you're not allowed to have a huge part of that, it undermines everything. And I think, honestly, I think that's a huge part of the problem the Catholic Church is having with sex abuse, is that they're forcing a huge percentage of their religious professionals to completely lie about who they are, both the women and the men and every other gender. And so, I want to name all the people who went before.
Speaking of going, I need to say goodbye. Okay. But thank you so much for having me.
Yeah.
Hi, everyone.
Yeah. And well, Catherine Klarenbach was asking about Jim Stoll. And Catherine, yeah, he served in Portland, actually, as a community minister. I remember because I went to college in Portland, and a woman, I was a house cleaner, a woman I was cleaning for said, oh, you're Unitarian. Oh, you know, I saw that they have a gay guy preaching there. And I thought to myself, this must have been about 1975. She said, I thought to myself, who but the Unitarians would care about that? And that's kind of what it was like. Who but the Unitarians?
Meg, I want to, with the evolution of rights and the evolution of dignity as human beings, the now leading edge for clergy is folks who are trans and folks who are in ethically non-monogamous relationships. And I think right now we have in our entire association three out trans ministers serving congregations. And I don't remember, but I want to say that I've seen numbers that say that the average length of a ministry for a trans minister is about 3 years, which is significantly shorter than other folks. And I just want to lift up what happened at the congregation where I am. I've got this little gem of a congregation. I can't tell you how happy I am here. But when I was in the interviewing process, there was some discomfort and some anxiety about what will it mean if we hire a trans minister? You know, are we all going to have to suddenly, you know, be super educated about trans stuff and defend our choice? And like, there was real anxiety. Like, what do we do? I mean, they don't even know how to be, right? And so I came for pre-candidating and we had a great time. And I came for my candidate, and I at the end of the pre-candidating weekend, there's that question at the end of the process where they say, is there anything that you see that would prevent you from being able to do ministry here? And so I said, let's talk about gender. Let's talk about gender. Because I know that the committee itself did a lot of really hard work to get to the place where they were like, okay, we can do this. We like you enough that we will figure this out. And I said, I appreciate that. And I also know that the entire congregation has not done that work. And so before I am able to entertain an invitation to be your candidate, I need to know that you're going to do, the whole congregation is going to do work on gender, because I'm not going to spend my first year explaining my pronouns. I've got other stuff to do. And the fascinating thing was, we were at lunch and they sort of huddled up. It was almost like I wasn't even there. And there was this conversation back and forth. Well, we need to do this work. It's going to cost money. We can find the money. But what if we do this work and Dawn doesn't come? We need to do this work anyway. Okay. It took 30 seconds and that's what they did. And I was like, I can come here. And they contracted with Alex Capitan, who came down and did a workshop before they even announced that I was their candidate. And then Alex has come back since then to talk about, how systems respond when there's a new thing in it. And they've really, really done the work. And I don't know that my colleagues who are trans identified are in places that have done that kind of stuff. But I feel really good here, but in other places I have not felt that welcome, you know?
Can you describe, I don't mean to make you relive trauma, but can you describe the kinds of microaggressions and the kinds of ways that the transphobia or whatever you would name it played out in those congregations? Because I'd like people to identify what might be going on in their own congregation, and also to lift up Alex Capitan and Michael Slack for their consulting business.
Yes.
That congregations that need help have someone they can call.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Those two are just amazing. They're doing amazing work. Because my pronouns are they, them, I get the regular sort of interrogation by retired English teachers who tell me that the language is inappropriate and I just can't do that. And when I correct people and say, excuse me, no, I use they, them pronouns, please use those. And they're like, oh, that's right. And the thing with a microaggression is that it's designed to not be enough to really talk about. You know, it's just a mosquito bite. But if you get enough of them, it's really miserable. I was in a conversation once with somebody at a congregation, and I said, you know, I use they, them pronouns, and the person said, I actually don't care. That wasn't actually microaggression, I don't think. You know, I've had that stuff. It's also challenging when I go to a congregation and there's no bathroom for me to use. This congregation, I love this place. The whole building was built 100% accessible, right? Whole building is accessible, wheelchair accessible. And they have two non-gendered handicap accessible single stall bathrooms. And one of them has a changing table. Yay, right? But bathrooms are a thing. I preached at a congregation, at a church in Maine a couple weeks ago when I was up there. And, you know, it's a facility where the church is, with the sanctuary is in one building and the minister's office and the administrative offices are in the building next door. And I, you know, between the services, I said, you know, is there a place where I can go to the bathroom? And the minister's like, hang on, we have to go next door. And you can use the one in my office. Like, I have to, like, in the winter, I would have to put on a coat, you know, and get bundled up and walk down the block to use the bathroom. Because, or, you know, I could risk getting shouted at in the women's room, which happens. It actually happened on my drive up to Maine, that trip. I got challenged. I like stopped once and I got challenged by five different people in that restroom. Excuse me, this is the women's room. And so I dropped the Bobby Brady voice and I say, yes, I know. I bring my voice back up. And I adjust my posture so I take up less space. And since I've recently had top surgery, and so people look at me and make assumptions about the rest of my body. The bathroom thing right now for me, the bathroom thing is just the biggest pain in the neck at churches because it's so easy to fix. But anyway, but these folks here have been really great. And I've got to scoot out because I've got a staff meeting in 5 minutes. So
thanks you so much for being here, Dawn, and happy coming out day.
Good to see you, everybody. All right. Yeah, take care now.
Great. It's great. Let's see. We have some other comments I wanted to bring in. Amanda Aikman says, in 1993, I pre-candidated at a church and heard they turned me down due to homophobia. The woman they called was very gracious to me. And a few years later, she came out and they had to deal with it. That was my mom's church and she was on the search committee. And she looked at me, her lesbian daughter, and said, yeah, we just a lesbian minister. We're already weird enough. That would just make us too weird. And so it's good to see that we've moved on that, and to lift up that what Dawn said about trans and gender queer folks and people in, what did she say, ethical non-monogamous relationships, you know, that hopefully we can evolve. Hopefully we can continue to evolve. And as people meet fabulous people, sadly, that old book, This Bridge Called My Back, sadly, the first people really are the bridges that get walked over, but hopefully it evolves. And I just want to name, of course, that for queer people of color, it's like the intersectionality, that there are horror stories of, about all of it. So all of the identities together, we are a white group today. And as far as I know, and Aisha and Christina are both at the board meeting. So it's those coming out stories of people of color are always nuanced in different kinds of ways, just to say, and my own kid being a queer person of color, yes, there are nuances to all of this. So we're wrapping up the hour. Nori, what else do you want to say to us?
Well, thanks for having me on the show. I think that we are evolving. I remember when I was having a conversation with my son, who was 14 at the time, about dating. And I said, do you think you'll want to date boys or you'll want to date girls? And he said, well, I don't know. And then he thought about it and he said, actually, I think I'll date girls, but I'll always be very supportive of the gay and lesbian community. So, you know, we're at least raising a generation. No matter how they identify, they're certainly more on board with the fabulous diversity of human life that's more diverse than we can even imagine. And I think that's going to create openings in the future that we can only just begin to see.
Thanks. Michael, you got any last words here?
You know, I was just struck hearing people talk about kids. And, you know, I have a child too, who's five, and I check in with her too about how she feels about herself. And there was a long time when I would ask, do you think you're a boy or a girl? And she'd go, I'm a Nora. I'm like, okay, well, maybe my child is genderqueer and maybe she will turn out to be, but I will continue to check in with her about that. Right. And allow her to tell me how she identifies and make a course correction if I need to, if I've been using the wrong pronoun. And I think that that's such a, you know, it's such a different environment. And it's one of the things that Unitarian Universalism teaches parents to do. We teach parents how to be sexuality educators and how to check in with their children and how to have, you know, whatever their child says, I'm gay and I love unicorns. Great. Like, how about we buy you some unicorn socks?
Well, and I want to say too that we, you know, one of the reasons that Liam was so comfortable coming out and being himself was because he did OWL, you know, for a fifth, sixth OWL. And that was a huge part of him getting a chance to talk about those things and think about them and really own who he is. And we do such a good job having our kids take OWL that I really think we as adults need to make sure that we're doing our OWL as well and making sure that we're there for our kids and doing our own work in that way.
That's a great transition. Thank you, Jess. That's hats off to all the religious educators. I channel Aisha and say that, my Aunt Christina. And I wanted to name that in my dreams, all of our churches have gender neutral bathrooms. So every transgender queer person ever traveling could know that they could stop in and have a safe place to go to the bathroom. Just in my dreams. It is not the case. And I wish it were. And it would be, as Dawn said, so easy to do. And so anyway, I'll just say that. And next week we have Dee Van Diver, who's down the block there from you, Jess.
Aren't I lucky? I'm so lucky.
I know. Has moved from New Orleans out to Bainbridge Island, or I don't even know if I got the right island, but an island. And Dee and Aisha are together writing a book about collaborative leadership. So we'll be talking about collaborative leadership. Nori, thanks for coming. Thanks also to our hosts who had to fly, or I guess who had to fly out. And see you next time. Thank you.
This has been an episode of The View. If you would like to learn more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.